Hello, it's Megan here from the Student Loan Planner Podcast, and I just wanted to give you a quick note before this episode starts that we are expanding our podcast selection for you. We've got a couple different profession-specific podcasts going live in the next couple weeks on November 7th. So if you are a physician, a dentist, or a veterinarian, we've got a brand new podcast stream coming your way, and it will be all things financial planning, student loan related, specifically for your profession. There's a lot of nuances to financial planning and student loan planning in particular to your profession. And what makes great information and great content? Well, information that is meant directly for you. So stay tuned for that coming out November 7th. We'll have some more information about those podcasts in future newsletters on the studentloanplanner.com newsletter. So if you're not subscribed to our Thursday update that we send out every week, make sure to do that and be on the lookout for the links to those new podcasts coming soon. So wanted to give you a little insight or inside knowledge before those go live. And with that, I'll let you get on to the rest of this episode. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today is our Friday financially free podcast episode. I've got Jake with me today. We're going to chat about a first child starter pack because having kids and getting prepared for that change in our life can be expensive or at least cost some money. So Jake, one of our newer fathers on the team, we've got actually a couple of team members that have recently had kids over the past year. But he's got personal experience and from a financial planning perspective, a lot of knowledge in this topic, and he is going to coach me through it. Not pregnant yet, but that's the plan in the future. But for a lot of our clients, that's maybe a next step in their financial plan. And so really chatting through like actually what it might cost, what the things we got to think about financially are, could be helpful. So hang out with us if this is you, or if you've got a sister or a sister-in-law or a family member that's about to go through this, maybe forward them the episode as well. Welcome, Jake. Thanks for chatting about this with me today.
Thanks for having me. This has been an experience. A new father. I have a 9-month-old.
Dang, 9 months already?
Holy I know. Cow. His birthday was January 3rd. So it's like I'm almost at 10 months now, but financially, it's been such a change. And today we'll talk about ways that we can prepare ourselves, things that I wish I would have even done way ahead of time when we found out that my wife was pregnant. And then things that once your baby's here, we should change, not maybe immediately the day you get back from the hospital, but, you know, shortly after.
Yeah.
Having kids can be such a massive change to your financial life.
And I bet.
Yeah. So we're excited to talk about that.
Man, I remember when I got my first dog, Boone, my Springer Spaniel, love of my life, my soul dog. He was a life changer, though. Like I had lots of come to Jesus moments where I was like, holy cow, this is hard. So I can only imagine like a child coming into the picture, like that being very different. Well, this is going to air right after Halloween. So you're probably listening to this after you've done a long night of trick or treating with the kiddos. Maybe you're still on that sugar high, or maybe you're going to steal some candy for a sugar high today. So what are you going to be going as for Halloween?
My son is a huge fan of Baby Shark, the song. And I know it's a little dated because I think it's been out for a few years now, but Baby it's Shark, weird. Like as soon as you start humming the chorus to it, he just like completely stops what he's doing and just stares at you and starts giggling.
Oh, sweet.
And so he's going to be a baby shark and my wife's going to be a lifeguard and I'm going to be a shark victim. So it's going to be as if he bit me in my rib cage and I'm going to be bleeding.
Because
he's
great.
Just a vicious baby shark right now.
Yeah, we're gonna have to grab a picture from you to put on the socials.
Yep, for sure. How about you?
My dogs are gonna be a bat and a butterfly. So we've got like little things that'll go around their arms to have the little things on their back. Me and Kelly are gonna be MGK and Megan Fox because our names are the same.
Nice.
So I'm going to tat him all up with some stick-on tattoos. I've got some things to spray in his hair. He's going to be wearing pink and I got a lot of jewelry for him and I've got a wig and it'll be a whole thing. So it's going to be, hopefully it'll be fun. I don't think anyone's going to know who we are though. Not kids, right? For MGK.
But, maybe Gen Z, you know?
Yeah, maybe Gen Z.
Is Kelly, your husband, tall? like MGK?
No, he's not tall and lanky, no. So no. He's going to have to bring his tall boots or something to the picture. But I think the tattoos will make it really come together. And then like sprayed hair, because I can make his hair kind of look like MGK's hair. So, Oh, and we also have like an electric guitar. So he'll carry that around with him. So it'll maybe help a little bit, but we'll see. We'll see if anybody
gets it. I bet they'll recognize him. Yeah. So before we talk about things to consider when we're expecting a baby, what is your favorite Halloween candy?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've already been eating my Halloween candy because I just have it in my pantry. I think I like Airheads. Airheads are my favorite. Mm-hmm. I can eat those all day, every day. What about you?
Don't judge me on this, but Whoppers.
Whoppers. Okay. I thought you were going to say candy corn.
No, that would be just crazy. But no, yeah. Whoppers and my wife tries them and she's like, how do you even like these things? I thought only old people like Whoppers.
You know? It's a weird texture. And when you bite into it, it's a weird crunch.
I know. Whoppers tend to be the things that people like push to the side. Like they'll eat the Reese's, the Snickers, you know, everything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not a really big fan of Whoppers. So I tend to get a lot of them.
Okay. Gotcha. I'll have to remember that for future reference. Well, all right. I need you to school me in what it's going to take to be prepared for bringing a first child into the world, or first children. Man, we've had a couple people on our team who have had twins. That's pretty wild because that's double the preparation, right?
Yeah.
We've got this split into four different categories to kind of chat through some changes and some things to think about in preparation. So one category is going to be cash flow, kind of the budgeting aspect of preparing for kids. Next is going to be risk management, so like life insurance or insurance in general. Third is going to be estate planning, so kind of the legal documents that you have to have in preparation. And then fourth is saving for their future, so with like 529s and, you know, education plans. So we'll chat through these different categories, but let's kick it off with cash flow. Tell me what I need to know. What do I need to start doing?
Number one, kids can be expensive if you didn't know that.
Everyone's like, duh, I know. Okay. Yeah.
So imagine you living your normal life and then all of a sudden you're expecting a baby. And then if you try to live your normal life, you have to add extra grocery bills, extra healthcare expenses, extra daycare expenses, which we'll talk in more specifics about. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about sometimes maybe even like a 20% increase, 30% increase in your lifestyle expenses. Mm-hmm. Just because this new humans is a part of your family now.
Well, and other things change too, right? Like I know it's not exact, but like you'll be doing less going out, maybe less entertainment with friends, less vacations for the first like year or two, possibly. And depending on what you feel like you can and cannot do with kiddos in the picture, some of those other expenses reduce. But yeah, it's never going to be a wash where we're spending less having kids. That's probably just not the reality, right?
Right. Yeah. Your lifestyle definitely changes in what you spend money on. Mm-hmm. And so it's always good to just get a baseline before your baby's here about what you spend in a month, how much excess cash you have left over, and then what you can do to cut back to make sure we're able to fit in an extra layer of $1,000, $2,000 a month, something like that, to get yourself prepared for it. So just starting with just an awareness of where you're at. But then we're talking about more of the direct expenses, right? So like the hospital and OB bills as you're preparing for delivery. There's not much you can change there in terms of like your expenses tied to those, right? So it's like your coverage today. Let's say, Megan, you're expecting in the spring of next year. Typically, it'll have a separate line item in your health insurance that says if you are pregnant. So every single health insurance option out there will have a summary of benefits and coverage page. Mm-hmm. It'll be like a 5-6 page document. It's like a mandated thing where they have to outline each one of your coverage options, right? So if it's a primary care visit, it's X copay, right? Or it's co-insurance or all of these. One of the things inside of that, it's not on the front page, but it's probably on page 3 or 4 of that. It says, if you are pregnant, and it says office visits, and it says labor and delivery. So first things first, you can see on average what you're going to spend when you go to, you know, an OB, start with like once a month, and then it goes into every other week, and then it's like weekly once it's really close. But those bills tend to add up. And then, of course, the delivery bill, and then all the testing and all the medicine that they give to you while you're in the hospital, all of those individual things add up a lot over time. So as you're going into the open enrollment season here, and you're expecting in the spring of next year, we're right at the open, and we just had a pod episode about open enrollment, but check the cost that says if you are pregnant. It breaks down what you can expect to pay as you're going through the delivery and everything involved.
Yeah, that's a good pointer. And you're exactly right. We're still kind of in open enrollment season. You and I are both on open market, so the ACA plan. And I wish we could access it right now. This is going to come out on November 1, where you could see kind of the inner workings of these plans. So I wish we could see it now. But from what I remember last year, and what you could probably tell in your own benefits, the benefit package information that you're going to be getting soon about your employer health insurance coverages, is like you were saying, like an estimated cost. And you could see for a normal delivery, normal pregnancy. And I think last year, don't hold fast to this number, but I think last year what the ACA was saying was a normal delivery would cost about $8,600. I'm curious what that says this year. We can't see it now, but I'm curious what it says this year. But that's good to know. Like, if you're expecting to start trying for kids, or you know that you're going to be, you know, giving birth next year, like the health insurance selection is really important. And open enrollment happens once a year. There is qualifying events where you can make changes to your health insurance, like when the baby's here, right? But pregnancy technically isn't a qualifying event to make changes to your policy. Is that right?
Right. That's right. Yeah. And I had a timing wise, it was a bad experience for me just in terms of enrolling in an ACA plan, because my son was born on January 3rd.
You missed that.
And we had all the OB appointments
before, the year before.
Right. I missed the child tax credit. So we had all the OB appointments the year prior, and then leading up to, you know, we actually had the delivery bill and, you know, the hospitalization bill in the next year.
Yeah.
And so adding my son to the ACA plan was just a nightmare back and forth. We had a United Healthcare as our insurer, and it was just back and forth, you know, of like, yes, this is my son, added him, you know, he was born this day, he should be covered, you know, with all of this. So, and, you know, I don't suggest having a baby the first part of the next year, but of course, you don't really have a lot of options and discretion.
Unless you could be the first baby born, because then you're in the newspaper, right? Like born January 1 at like 1201, whatever it is. That's cool. You'll get the fame, but no financial benefits.
Right. So yeah, definitely check that out. Like, it even breaks down, I think it says Peg is having a baby, for an example case of that summary benefits and coverage page. Peg is having a baby. It's a line by line item cost, and then the total cost at the bottom of that. That will give you an idea, because it will make a huge difference if it's a copay for a hospitalization visit versus a co-insurance that only pays a percent, right? That can that can be the difference between a $500 labor and delivery charge versus a full deductible, you know, you're paying your full $6,000 or whatever your deductible might be. So it can be a very, very stark difference in terms of the selection you pick there.
Yeah. And we talked a bit about selection in the last episode. So if you missed that one, go check that one out, where Sim and I kind of chat through the different health insurance categories. I've historically been on a high deductible healthcare plan, but this year I will be comparing, like, does it make sense for us to maybe do like a PPO plan or something with maybe higher premiums, but not as much out of pocket for the deductible. So those are the things that you want to maybe take a look at and run some numbers on. And if you have a planner or a person in your life who can help you run the numbers, even better.
Yep.
And then another thing to think about, last little note on health insurance slash benefits, look into maybe a dependent care FSA as well. Dependent care FSAs help cover the cost of what it's going to cost you to pay for childcare. So daycare or nanny or, you know, some kind of qualifying childcare if you and your spouse are both working. It's a deduction. You put this money into kind of like a savings account, kind of like a flexible savings account. You can reimburse yourself for those childcare costs. I think the limit is $5,000. Is that still right for next year? I think it is.
I think so. Yep.
Yeah. So not a ton. Your child care is probably going to cost a lot more than that, but you still get the tax deduction on the $5,000 and reduces the cost a little bit for you and kind of forces the savings for it as well.
Yep. And then the other thing is parental leave.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you're offered a parental leave benefit. Mm-hmm. All right. So a paid parental leave, even if it's 60% of pay, it's still better than nothing. One thing that is kind of like a phantom parental leave is a short-term disability policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to obtain a short-term disability policy outside of your employer if you're already pregnant, right? Because
right.
the insurer is not going to say, hey, we'll approve you for a policy, even though we know that you're on track to have a baby next year. And we know that mm-hmm. we're going to pay it, you know, the policy,
yeah.
right? So this is, if you're planning to have a baby in the future, great idea to have a short-term disability policy there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have any sort of pay, right, whether it's short-term disability or a parental leave benefit, then it's really just build up your, we can call it pregnancy savings. It's an emergency mm-hmm. savings fund that is meant to supplement the income that you would have made during that time that you're used to living off of, that you can draw down from. That's like what we consider like the worst case scenario, is you have to build up cash over the next, I don't know, 6 months until your due date. But mm-hmm. I would do anything you can to try to build yourself a cash cushion to supplement your income while you're not making any.
Yeah. And check with your employer, see what they offer. If you have a short-term disability policy, you might not even be paying for it. So you might not know you have it, but you might have it because the employer's paying for it. Or you can opt in during your open enrollment season. So make sure to check out short-term disability. And you can call that provider that, you know, lots of different companies provide disability insurance policies. But you could call that provider and ask questions about like exactly how you could go out on claim, how much it covers, and give you like the details you might need for the money, the math on how much will be coming in from that policy. I also like to mention like long-term disability insurance, the importance of that. It may not kick in regularly for a regular pregnancy and a regular birthing experience, but long-term disability insurance can kick in if you are taking longer to get back to work because you did have a difficult either pregnancy or a difficult birthing experience. It can kick in, I think, as short as 3 months, depends on your policy, but it can shorten mm-hmm. as short as 3 months after you're out on claim. If you've already exhausted like short-term disability benefits, could be as long as a year though. It really depends on the policy, but that's a nice, like good backup option for like, if you're out unexpectedly for longer than you thought because of something that went awry, or you're just taking longer to physically or mentally recover from your birthing experience. So I like to mention that as well. So if you don't have that through your employer, or you'd like to supplement on top of your employer policy, that's something to look into independently as well. Long-term disability. Some folks don't have employer benefits, right? So let's talk a little bit about that, because then we're going to have to rely on ourselves to kind of beef up our savings, which we always recommend 3 to 6 months of necessary expenses in our emergency reserves anyways. But if you don't want to deplete that down to zero, you know, being out for 3 months, it's probably a great idea to build up, like you were saying, Jake, like a baby savings fund for those mm-hmm. months where maybe pay is lower or pay is non-existent because we don't have employer coverage, or we're an independent person working 1099 where we only make money when we're working. So that's important to start building up as well in anticipation of the income change when you're out of work.
Right. And you don't necessarily know if your baby will require a specific formula that's only made in X country.
True.
And because of the allergens, right? So you don't necessarily know. So you kind of have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best with this. Once you have the baby, is a great tool to use as Costco or Sam's Club to buy formula if they're okay with just your typical formula that's available out there, because you can buy a lot for in bulk, you know, if you know you're going to be using it over time. So
that's
the key reason why we signed up for Sam's Club, is so we could buy formula and diapers.
That makes sense, because, you know, a lot of people love Costco. They love Sam's Club. We do have a membership now, but we don't go very often because it's just me and my husband and my dogs right now. Mm. I can't buy that much in bulk for it to make sense for us, because we're not going to use it in time.
Right.
You know, things like, I know, like paper towels, toilet paper, stuff like that could be helpful. But especially when you have a baby and you literally need things in bulk, like diapers, formula, you know, that could be a good thing to maybe take advantage of, is those big wholesale clubs. And yeah, just having like extra savings for the unexpected with your baby. Like, you don't know if you're going to have to try out 5 different formulas because the first four didn't work for their tummy, or if they have mm-hmm. sensitive skin and you have to try out a bunch of different diapers or a bunch of different lotions. So having that extra pad can be really helpful to just not stress about where the money's going to come from when you're having to find something that's going to make your baby the most comfortable.
Right.
Student loans. How do they affect student loans?
Oh, man. Yeah. So think about what happens if you don't have a parental leave benefit. Your income just drops, right? And it's an opportunity that we can at least save you on your student loan payment while you're preparing for to have a baby and have a baby. It's like we can theoretically, depending on your tax filing status, your spouse's income, all those sorts of things, your student loan payment should drop significantly if you go from making $100,000 to $0, and mm-hmm. even in a short amount of time. So definitely something we suggest in the vast majority of cases. I can't think of a case where we wouldn't necessarily suggest this unless they already had a very, very low payment from an old income.
Yeah.
But yeah, go in and recalculate your student loan payment. If you're expecting, that's an addition to your family size. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not born yet, right? So your additional family size, if you've recertified recently, you can add one more to your family size and thus your payment becomes lower with mm-hmm. a higher family size. So just something, just a little tidbit there to help you on your student loan payment while you're expecting and then when you have a baby.
Yep. And technically your family size for student loan purposes increases while you're pregnant. So unlike taxes, like where you can't claim a dependent until they're born, for the student loan payment, you can claim a higher family size with an unborn child. So that's pretty cool because that, again, can reduce your payment. But yeah, you just have to do the math to make sure, you know, does it make sense to recalculate your payment, or does your current income, even with the higher family size, make your payment higher than what it is right now? At which point it might be better to hold off until you're actually out on mat leave with the baby, making 60% of your income or making zero, depending on your employer situation at the time.
Yep.
You know, and that's when you're answering questions like an attorney. You know, what is your taxable income today? That's what you tell them when you're recalculating your payment.
Yep.
So good tips there for student loans to reduce some load on the cash flow. But let's talk about things that will kind of go the reverse way with daycare, something that we have to start to add into the picture as an expense.
When you're married, daycare, of course, can be very expensive. And we always have to run the numbers about like, okay, if your spouse or you are making a modest income, maybe you're part-time or something like that, does mm-hmm. it make sense to continue to pursue, like at least temporarily, you know, continue with that job and pay for daycare? Or does it make sense to not, right? Or maybe, you know, there's such thing as drop-in daycares now that are pretty sufficient. There's one right down the road from me. Really nice benefit. You can't keep your child there for more than 20 hours a week and, you know, more than 7 hours a day. So it has, but it's made for those gig workers that are working 3 hours this day, 3 hours the next day, those sorts of places. So there's definitely adaptable daycares out there.
Okay.
But just in general, think about what's happened with our demographics. We as millennials are the largest generation out there. And the largest generation is having more and more kids right now. And there's mm-hmm. just a supply and demand imbalance of caregivers and daycares. And mm-hmm. that's what's driven up the price of daycare. There's just so many kids that need daycare now. And thus, even though you might have 10 daycares down the road, they're all charging. I mean, I'm in Tennessee and our weekly rate is $350 and we're on the lower end of the spectrum.
Wow. Yeah. I talked to somebody the other day who was $850 a week. Yeah. And I think they were somewhere in New York, but the price range widely varies. And that's why it's important to also shop daycares. Also, like kind of like you were saying, there might be a high price for the demand issue, but there might also be a wait list where they mm-hmm. literally don't have room to add anybody else. So there might be a wait list where a lot of areas, as soon as you find out you're pregnant, you want to start like looking for places for daycare when that time comes, because you might be on a wait list until, you know, a lot longer than you'd want to be.
That's a great point. And follow up with the daycares that you're put on the wait list with, because mm-hmm. I swear they make a business out of charging people to be put on a wait list and never tell them when the spot is open.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, be annoying if you have to.
Yeah, be annoying. Be like, hey, just want to know where I'm at on the list.
Just checking in. Kindly annoying. It's like yeah. nudging, you know, a gentle nudge.
Yep.
I know some folks can also maybe have flex schedules. Like, this is what I'm hoping, like with me and my husband, we both work from home. I'm hoping we could have a pretty flexible schedule where one of us takes one kid, or one of us takes like a full day for childcare on the back end of the week. One of us takes a full day on the front end of the week. And I'm hoping that I have some parental help. My mom is a librarian right now, but she's really itching to retire. And I would love to have my mom as caretaker and maybe pay her a reasonable wage while she's in retirement to take care of her grandbabies. I know that's a blessing. Like, a lot of people don't have that support. But that could be an option as well if you have family members that are open to that, even if you're, you know, I wouldn't start with the notion that it's going to be free. Like, start with the notion of, hey, I'll pay you a reasonable wage for this. But if it could be free, great, even better. But maybe leaning on family or local options. I know certain neighborhoods have like I forget exactly what it's called, but it's like a neighborhood program where one family or one household takes the childcare 1 week, and then it rotates to the next family, and then it rotates to the next. I don't know how common those are, but I have heard more and more about neighborhood options or like group childcare within your neighborhood, which I thought was pretty interesting. So it might be some like alternative options that you could look into as well for daycare.
Yeah. If you're in a kind of a tight-knit neighborhood, I would say that's one of the things, like, for example, like we reached out on our neighborhood Facebook group for like an evening babysitter, right? So we can do date night and all those sorts of things. So if you're in a tight-knit neighborhood that has kids that are in college or something like that, like that's a great option to hire someone for $20 an hour and, you know, and have them watch your baby for a few hours.
And also employer benefits. There's some companies, well, there's not a ton, but some companies like Chick-fil-A corporate here in Georgia, they have daycare on site and it is an employer perk. So people drive into work at the corporate Chick-fil-A office, they drop off their kiddo right at the front of the campus, and then they drive into the office and they work and they go pick them up at the end of the day. Beautiful option. Holy cow. That's amazing. That's why Chick-fil-A is so great.
Except they're not open on Sundays.
Yeah, except for they're not open on Sundays.
I bet their daycare isn't either.
No, I bet you. No, I think it's just Monday through Friday. But some employers have options as well. Could be as small of an option, but still impactful as the FSA dependent care like we were talking about. So maybe check out what they have available as well. And then last thing on cash flow or the money side of it is dependent care credit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we get a tax credit for paying for daycare. In a nutshell, that's exactly what it is. And it ranges from 20% to, I think, 35% of the cost, maybe even 40% of the cost, but the income ranges are fairly low. So for most folks out there, it's 20% of the dependent care cost. This does not include your sister-in-law that's coming over and you're paying her cash for a few hours of work, right?
So has to be on payroll.
Has to be on payroll, right? So you can't get away with that. But it's a way to kind of ease the burden of daycare. And most daycares will send you a tax form come the next year that says, you know, you spent this much and here's our daycare EIN number. And you just plug that in your tax software or give that to your tax preparer and you get a credit for 20% of that amount up to a cap. I want to say the cap is $1,200 of credit, right? So up to $5,000 or $6,000 of expenses can be claimed in that credit.
Yeah.
Something else to consider too is if you have both a dependent care FSA and of course, you have a dependent care credit. Everybody does. You can't double dip, right? So so you can only spend $5,000 of your dependent care FSA, and then you only get the credit for anything above and beyond the
$5,000. You
know, the $5,000.
Yeah, which a lot of people do end up spending more than that. So you can't double dip, but you might end up still being able to use both income permitting and expense permitting, of course.
Yep. $350 a week for me is $16,000 for the year. So it's definitely, we're getting there.
Well, good. I think that covers some of our cash flow things to think about and kind of mentally and physically, financially prepare for. Let's chat about risk management. So insurance, life insurance. A lot of times when we're talking about life insurance, some of the needs that really pop into the picture are if you have dependents, and that could be dependents in the sense of like your spouse depends on your income or depends on you 100% financially. but also like your children will depend on you 100%, or your spouse or your significant other, you know, relies on the money that you're bringing into the household. So life insurance is a great way to just protect your family members in the event that you have a premature passing, which is, of course, a really depressing thing to think about, but it's a very real thing to have to think about, because there are very unexpected circumstances that could come into play, and you don't want to leave your family in a bad financial position or have to change their life or their standard of living because, you know, something unfortunate were to happen. Because not only are we dealing with the emotional side of it, but then the family is dealing with the financial side of it, which can be also really catastrophic. But what are some of the things that you talk about with your clients, or like that you've done personally with life insurance with dependents coming into the mix?
Yeah. So we need to replace our future income at least for 25 years is usually the mark that I recommend. And think about 25 years from now, hopefully your child will be financially independent by the time they're 25, but they could be going to med school, dental school, you know,
might still be supporting a little bit,
a little bit here and there, but 25 years is a good mark to at least start with. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we want to have the life insurance coverage at least until retirement, right? So retirement, because by the time we're retired, then we have enough assets to kind of replace our living over our living expenses over time. Definition of retirement. But kind of a rule of thumb, and I know there's a lot of rule of thumbs in finance, but usually about 10x your gross income is usually what we tend to recommend at Student Loan Planner as a starting point. Now that can adjust here and there, depending on your tax rate, you know, if you're planning an early retirement, those sorts of things. But just in general, 10x is a good measure there. Especially if you're the breadwinner, you want to get that life insurance in place and then make sure it's designed properly to where your primary beneficiary is likely your spouse, and then the contingent beneficiary is your kids. And we'll talk about ways that we can make sure that your one-year-old child doesn't inherit $1 million and can, you know, we'll talk about ways that we can kind of combat that risk. But
that'll come next in estate planning.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, so usually about 10x our income is kind of what we're getting to. The other thing too, it replaces not only your future income, but also for the non-breadwinner spouse, if there's things like we talk about childcare and cleaning and other things that the non-breadwinner spouse could be responsible for, running the kids to baseball practice.
All the activities,
all the activities, right? Someone needs to do those things still if that person passes away. And so we have to think about what would that extra cost be on a monthly basis to hire somebody to do that, or where you could take maybe some time off work, you know, maybe you go from 40 hours a week to 30 hours a week so you can do it. So you need to replace that 10 hours a week of income. We run that analysis within with our clients, right? So we really want to get a nice round number of what that income replacement should be.
Yeah, should be. Yeah. And there's that rule of thumb, like you said. You could also look at it from like a, what debts do you have in the mix that you'd want to pay off for your spouse if you were to not be here? Like think about joint debts that you have together, like the home, the mortgage, any car loans that you maybe have outstanding, any private student loans. Federal student loans will be forgiven upon someone's premature passing. But think about it from like a debt perspective and then like the income replacement perspective too, if the other spouse is earning income. But yeah, you're exactly right. Like it's wrong to think that a stay-at-home spouse doesn't have a life insurance need, because they are doing a lot of unpaid labor that someone's going to have to do, or you're going to have additional help brought in to help with some of those things potentially.
Yep.
And you can also think about life insurance needs from like a future perspective. Like if it's really important to you and your spouse to provide some education savings or support for your kids in the future, but a premature passing, I mean, that would really potentially derail that. So maybe saving for future things, or having that as an amount baked into the life insurance need, like an education fund, like how much ideally could you kind of carve out from that lump sum that would come into the picture to pay for education, so your spouse doesn't have to worry about that side of the equation.
Right. And the other thing too, when you find out you're pregnant, there could be a chance where you apply for life insurance and they deny you because you're pregnant.
Yeah.
There could be a possibility of that. I'm not saying that that's a definite thing. So if you have employer-sponsored life insurance, that would, of course, be a great opportunity to buy up the supplemental life insurance to at least get something in place. And then once the delivery is over, you know, after that, then you can go and apply for a private policy that sticks with you through multiple employers.
And you can ladder policies too. So something I've done kind of in anticipation of having kids in the future is I did get a term life insurance policy in my 20s. It was a 20-year term though, and I wasn't planning on having kids anytime soon. So I knew that timeline wise, that wasn't going to be all I needed, that, you know, that was going to be something that I'd still have a coverage need after the 20 years lapsed, but it would cover like the things that it needed to cover at the time. So I did purchase a second policy to ladder on top of that first policy later on. Now it's a 30-year. I think I just went with a different carrier that had a longer term. So I have a 20-year that'll expire, I think sometime in the 2030s. And then I'll have a 30-year that expires later, which should completely cover like that 25-year timeline that I think you were talking about for kiddos.
That's great. I always suggest the latter.
Instead of everything like expiring at one point, you can have some gradual drops of coverage over time. That way you're protected. But as your need goes down, as your kids are growing up, then that coverage is also going down naturally with the latter.
Yep.
Estate planning. Let's talk a little bit about this. And so we'll kind of tie in the life insurance. Let's say you do have your spouse listed as a beneficiary or your kids listed as a contingent beneficiary, and you're kind of hoping, since we talked about this already, we'll start there, but you're hoping that, you know, you don't want your kids to blow the cash that they're receiving in that event. Mm-hmm. Or just in general, like the assets that you have, you want to make sure are dispersed in the way that you would like them to be dispersed if in the event that you are not here or in the event that you're incapacitated and can't make those decisions. Estate planning documents are really helpful in these areas, right? And I think you were kind of going down the line of talking about maybe a trust or some kind of, you know, legal documents in place. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. But first, at least get your beneficiaries set up, right? So you have to you change your beneficiaries. That's like hard stop. And you can log into your financial account provider and change your beneficiaries just right off that. Even if your child's not born yet, you can always put, you know, next of kin or certain language in there that implies
per stripes or something.
Yeah, per stripes is the Latin word for it. Yeah. So it'll just, you know, move on to your kids if your spouse passes at the same time. But at least get the beneficiary set up and updated. And then you get into the estate planning documents. And I'll just, to kind of break this down as simply as possible, you have a starter estate plan, which is basically like a will and powers of attorney. And a will is almost, think of that as almost like a point in time. When you pass away, you get to direct the transfer of your assets. The probate court will interpret the will according to your needs, according to what it's written by, but it'll also appoint somebody as your children's guardian for care.
Very important.
And financial guardian, right? So your sister is not the most financially savvy person, but you know they're a great parent, for example. So there'd be a great caretaker for your kids, but then you appoint your brother-in-law as the financial guardian, right? Because you know that, you know, he's great with money. He's, you know, he's sharp. He's not going to make any terrible decisions there. So you get the opportunity in your will to name those people and for your pets too, right? So that's, you know, Megan, for you, like that's a great for, for fur babies. Like
who's going to take care of my crazy fur babies?
Right. Yeah. So you get to make that decision by setting up a will and having those transfer of assets and then who's the caretaker. What happens after that, you don't really have an option to determine it unless you have the next level of estate planning, which is a trust.
A trust sounds pretty like frou-frou, like, ooh, like very rich and fancy, but it's not. Anybody can really open up a trust, and it really helps, kind of like we're saying, like these foundational things, I think, are the easy, lower hanging fruit things to do. But a trust establishment could be really helpful for an added layer of protection, I guess you could say, and also just much more clear expectations of assets and of distributions and things for different reasons. Because you could have a trust kick in if you are still living but not able to make decisions, or you can have it kick in as soon as you pass, where it's like revocable up until that point where you're alive, you can make changes to it. So a trust is something that it's not just for the rich. It's not just for folks who make, you know, a ton of income or have a ton of assets. It can be a really helpful document for many families to make sure that things happen the way you want them to happen in events that you can't make decisions. Is that how you would say it too?
I tend to think of a trust as something that lets you control your assets way past your passing, right? Mm-hmm. So there's literally an unlimited amount of time for a trust if you really wanted to. So there's something like generation skipping trust, and mm-hmm. it can get really complex with that. Typically, high net worth folks like to use trust as a kind of like a tax minimization mechanism mm-hmm. Over time, because they can gift to the trust and then the trust isn't taxed until it's dispersed. But in general, if you have young kids, if you're expecting for the first time, this ensures that your one-year-old gets the proper distribution from your assets to cover education, health. There's I forget the name for this specific language in the trust, but it's basically all of the necessities, right? So your financial mm-hmm. guardian, the trustee says, yep, that's just, you know, we need to pay for the school. We'll distribute from the trust. Mm-hmm. It ensures that your one-year-old doesn't receive $1 million and your financial guardian says, oh yeah, they need to buy a yacht in Florida or something like that, right? So it just kind of gives you that added level of protection that you've built your assets up your entire life, or you've got a life insurance policy for $1.5 million or $3 million. And that's a lot of money, but you can ensure that your child doesn't actually have any discretion over it until they're 25 or 30 years old. So you have full customization there.
That's a good point too. Going back to the life insurance, you can name a person the beneficiary of money upon your passing, but you could also name a trust as the beneficiary. And so the money goes to the trust in the event you pass or your spouse passes, and then the money has to pay out per the terms of the trust. The beneficiary of the trust could still be who you technically would have named the beneficiary of the life insurance policy. But if you want control over how that money is spent when that money comes through, then you can have the trust. And I think it's HIMSS, health, education, maintenance, and support. Those are the typical standards for like a minor, like how to make sure that someone is taken care of as a minor or as like a dependent. It doesn't have to be a minor, but that makes sure that the basics are taken care of. And then there could be terms for like above and beyond that. Then maybe you get X amount of dollars at 25, X amount of dollars for your wedding day, X amount of dollars. Mm-hmm. Like you can really list it out how you want to list it out, which is pretty cool.
And don't forget that it gives you control and those dollars are still invested, right? So it's still growing in the trust. And so, you know, your $1 million can turn into $5 million by the time they're 18 mm-hmm. or what, you know, whenever the trust can start distributing assets. But keep that in mind too. It just gives you more control.
Yeah, we used to use trusts a lot in settlement planning. I did settlement planning, which was back, you know, when somebody gets a really large lump sum for, usually it's a personal injury settlement. And sometimes there would be kids getting personal injury settlements. And of course, like the court doesn't want a kid walking away with $1 million. They want to see some kind of plan for that money to where it's not going to be taken advantage of by the parents, which unfortunately happens, mm-hmm. or from other family members. And they want to make sure it is used for the health, education, maintenance of that child, and also like for their benefit in the future. So trusts are very valuable in financial planning because it helps just remain in control of things that you'd want to remain in control of.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool. Is that all on legal documents that you think are helpful? I think the only thing I added on there was UTMA, UGMA, which those are like minor checking savings vehicles that you could open, but they do transfer ownership at the age of majority, which for most states is age 18. So think about it as like a minor's checking or savings account where you have control over it until their age of majority. But then when they turn that age of majority, 18, 19, 20, it's their money. Like you have no control over it anymore. So those are types of accounts that you may or may not want to use, but something that you might hear about.
Right. Yep.
Last thing, let's talk about saving for the future. So we're having kiddos. You probably have some goals for their education. You're listening to this podcast because you probably have student loans. So you feel one way or another about how your college experience, your schooling experience went financially. And you probably want to, you know, you have ideas about what you'd like for your child. So there are things that you could utilize, like 529 plans, prepaid tuition plans for paying for the cost of education in the future. What I think you're like really versed in 529s because you help our team with the 529 talk.
I love 529s.
Yeah, you do.
I celebrate May 29th every year, 529
Oh
day.
My gosh. You're like, this is like 529s for you is like the equivalent of HSAs for Sim.
For Sim,
like if we're
yeah.
at a cocktail party, Jake's going to be talking about 529s. Sim's going to be in another corner talking about HSAs. We're a ball of fun over here, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly.
But tell us about why you love them.
First, I would just preface this and say, most of the time, it makes more sense to make sure that your bases are covered for retirement mm-hmm. and your own personal goals before we start allocating excess cash flow to 529s. Mm-hmm. So while I'm a huge fan of them, they're meant for your kids and you don't want to sacrifice your own retirement right. goals because you have just less time, way less time than your kids mm-hmm. do to pay off student loans. I just met with a student loan borrower that had her undergraduate education paid for through a 529.
Nice.
And her first year of dental school was in, her first loan disbursement was in August of 2014. Mm. So by doing that, because her parents started a 529 plan, she's eligible for new IBR, which
right.
if you've heard our past episodes, that's an awesome plan. And you can go yeah. through these court cases with a little bit of surety that you have that plan available for you. Mm-hmm. That just kind of speaks to like, hey, you know, if you cover undergrad, you'll at least have some timing delayed for grad loans. But mm-hmm. the 529 plan is in general is a, can be sometimes a triple tax advantaged account. So a lot of people think of HSAs when they think about, hey, tax deductible coming in, the growth is tax-free inside of the account, and then distributions are tax-free on the way out. Mm-hmm. 529 plans are not federally deductible when you contribute to them, but they grow tax-free and they're mm-hmm. distributed from also tax-free as long as they're used for qualifying expenses, which there's a whole laundry list of things you can mm-hmm. use these accounts for. Sometimes yeah. your state will provide a state income tax deduction.
Up to a certain amount.
Up to a certain amount, right? Mm-hmm. For example, like I think Colorado has like a $30,000 state income tax deductions.
Oh,
you
dang.
Can contribute up to $30,000.
Holy cow.
You know, if you're married filing jointly. So there are some mm-hmm. states that really encourage folks to contribute mm-hmm. to 529 plans. Think of this as almost like a Roth IRA. So that tax-free growth happens in retirement. Mm-hmm. So like you pay taxes technically on the wages that you contribute to it, but it's all tax-free growth. Mm-hmm. Think about the cost of education in 18 years from now. Would you rather pay, let's say $400 a month now or $300,000 in 18 years from now, right?
Yeah.
So you got to have to think about that, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. and you get the tax incentive along the way because by the time your son or daughter is 18 months old, that could be some of your highest earning years when you mm-hmm. need to distribute from the account to pay for that first year of college, right? So if you're doing that from a brokerage account, you're taxed on the capital gains mm-hmm. and then you're also paying the bill for the $40,000 a year tuition, you know, something
right.
like that.
Right. Yeah. So the taxes
awesome.
Are something to consider. Yeah. And so 529s, I think sometimes folks get scared about 529s because of just the limitations. But I know you kind of argue against that, like where they're not as limited as you would think with how much you could spend, like what types of things you could spend them on. Is that how you see it?
Yeah. So obviously we mentioned a laundry list of things that we can spend on from the account. Mm-hmm. Obviously tuition and room and board are the most obvious, but a lot of people don't know like laptops, books, mm-hmm. off-campus housing. So if they're living in an apartment and mm-hmm. they're at least mm-hmm. a half-time student, you can pay for rent from these, mm-hmm. from these accounts, trade schools. And also one of the biggest arguments is if they receive a scholarship, then what do we do with
oh,
the money,
yeah.
right?
That's a good one. We get that a lot, you know, yeah. that question.
So you can withdraw the amount of the scholarship in the year the scholarship's received without mm-hmm. a tax penalty.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So that could just counter against that argument where, you know, well, I didn't realize, you know, my kid got a full ride scholarship, which woohoo, that's great. But then you're
right.
like, man, I was so responsible. I saved all this money in my 529. So you're saying if that's the case, then you can pull out pretty much what the scholarship was penalty free. Is that right? Penalty and tax free? Or is it just penalty free?
Just penalty free.
Gotcha. So you miss yes. out on the tax benefit, but it's avoiding that annoying like penalty that right. you would have to pay if you use it for something else that was not qualifying. Right.
Mm-hmm. Normally in a situation like that, if they have multiple kids, we would just change the beneficiary of that account, the 529 account,
yeah,
to their
that's a good point
youngest.
Too.
That would be like the worst case scenario. And then you can change it to grandchildren in the future. So there's something called Dynasty 529s out there mm-hmm. that have lasted for years and years because there's no contribution limit to a 529 plan.
Yeah.
If the plan is at $500,000, I don't think you can contribute at that point. So it's mm-hmm. like a value limit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, think about $500,000 compounded at 7% rate of return over three generations. I mean, that can be a yeah. sizable amount, right?
Yeah.
Gotcha. So they're another tool in the tool belt to for mm-hmm. you to accomplish a goal for a especially high income family that's at a high tax rate, and we really wanted to take advantage of that tax free growth for education, mm-hmm. and then I would say out of like the ladder of education funding accounts, whether it's your 529 plan, your UTMAs, your brokerage accounts. Like I would cover at least the state income tax deduction first. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you're still not sure about it, maybe do your own brokerage account or something like that for it, but get something in the 529 plan because that thing will really pay off over time.
Yeah. And you can have family members contribute to it as well, which is pretty cool. That could be something that you put on like birthday cards, like inviting folks over for birthday parties. Here's my 529 QR link, or here's how you can contribute, or yeah. the name of the 529. Like, that's a pretty cool way for people to be able to contribute to your child's future as well. And one last little thing with 529s that's somewhat recent is if you've got some money in there unused, you don't have someone you want to, you know, change the beneficiary to, you could also roll some into a Roth IRA for the child.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know how that works mechanically?
Yeah, so from my understanding, because it is very, very new, the account has to be open for at least 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to make sure that the beneficiary is at least 15 years old before you do this. You can transfer directly from the 529 to the beneficiary's Roth IRA mm-hmm. in increments of whatever the annual contribution limit is of that year, right?
So gotcha. Okay.
This year it's 7,000. 15 mm-hmm. years from now, let's say you open one up today, you're expecting a child, you're going to open up a 529 plan, start funding it. 15 years from now, it might be more like 11,000, whatever the inflation adjusted amount is. You can do that all the way up until you get a lifetime maximum of $35,000 transferred mm-hmm. to the Roth IRA.
Gotcha. So that's a good option too for folks. Like if there's reasons why you save too much in that account, which is a fantastic problem to have, like pat yourself on the back if you've gotten to that point. Usually it's, hey, we didn't save enough in that account, right? Yep. But if you save too much in that account, then you've got some options for like, you know, rolling it into the Roth IRA, like we talked about, transferring it to another beneficiary of either a sibling or a grandchild. And also taking the equivalent out from what you maybe got as a scholarship and just avoiding the penalty, but having to pay the taxes on it.
Exactly. So thinking about this, there is kind of a little low-key strategy here. You can name yourself as a beneficiary of your 529. Mm-hmm. You can deposit, we'll call it $11,000. And then over 15 years, an average rate of return of 7%, you're at $30,660. And then you can transfer to your own Roth IRA. So you can keep doing that. You can get more money into a Roth IRA by just doing an initial deposit of 11, right? So that's another kind of cool thing about this rule is that no one says that you can't create a 529 plan for yourself and make a contribution to it.
Yeah, so. That is true. And if you don't have kids yet, you could start a 529, like you said, with you as the beneficiary and then transfer this to your child in the future if you want mm-hmm. to. So pretty cool little strategies there if education savings is really important to you.
Yep.
Well, great. We talked about quite a bit. I think this is helping me kind of see a bigger picture of the money side of having kiddos. Not the last conversation we'll have on this topic, I'm sure, but I think this is a good starting point for folks to get some of these nuggets of information, put it in your back pocket for later or for, you know, as this is happening in your life. Any last words before we wrap things up?
Try to get as much sleep as you can before the baby comes, if this is you.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the like physical, psychological changes on this one, but maybe we'll bring like a therapist on the call for that one.
Yeah. And when you're at like a month or two in, I promise you it does get better in terms of your sleep. So it will get better over time.
Aww.
You know, every client that we talk to, as I, you know, my son was just born, he's like, how's it going? And then it'd be like, I have a 4 month old and they get way better at 4 months. And then I reach 4 months and be like, is it getting better yet? And they're like, oh, 6 months is the way to, is really when it gets better. So it is kind of a rolling basis, but it does get better over time in terms of like feeling like your normal self again, about getting sleep and,
yeah,
and kind of going through that
your
process.
Routines. Routines will change, of course, but you'll be in a new routine at some point. Really cool.
Yeah. So expecting a child can be full of emotion. It can be anxiety ridden. It can be very stressful. It doesn't have to be financially stressful, because we can help you get to the starter pack that we talked about today. So if that's you, if it is stressing you out with, you know, when you're trying to book your daycare, get on the waiting list, everything like that, and you're looking at average hospital bills, et cetera, go to slpwealth.com/book and book an intro call with us. We can help ease that anxiety so you can worry about other things like raising a child, mm-hmm, rather than your money situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I would leave the group with.
Yeah. That's a great way to end it. If this is keeping you up at night, or this is really something that's either postponing starting a family or preventing you from starting a family, like, I think if we can get your money situation right and we have a game plan, or if you're in the midst of this, like you just found out that you're having a baby and you're stressed about it, we can help. We can certainly help, what Jake said. So that's a great way to end it. Thanks so much, Jake, for joining. And don't eat too much candy this weekend. Jake, your dental clients would say that. Don't eat milk duds, right? Don't eat milk duds.
They're terrible for your teeth.
Brush your teeth, floss, make sure you're flossing this weekend, and we'll catch you on the next one.
What if you could get fiduciary financial planning specific to your profession that's student loan aware, that could change your life for a price much better than you ever dreamed possible? If that sounds good to you, go to slpwealth.com/pod for a free, no obligation, 15-minute intro call with one of our own fiduciary financial planners to see if we could be a good fit for you. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.